welcome to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to Charlotte Fruity Metcalf, editor of the Oldie Supplements.
Hello.
And we're talking about the new August issue, and the cover piece is on the late, great David Hockney by his friend, biographer and fellow Yorkshireman, Christopher Sykes, who wrote the two-volume books, Hockney, the Fully Authorised Biography. And you like this one, Fruity?
I really like this piece because, for once, it wasn't about his art as much about a 70th birthday party that Christopher Sykes had obviously been to at Sledmere House in 2007. And it was really interesting because I hadn't realised he had
this. Which is, in fact, the Sykes family home.
So Christopher had hosted it. And there's a really lovely photograph of the family, and I hadn't realised he had so many siblings, nor indeed how incredibly close he was to his three brothers and his sister. And I didn't know very much about him, and this article's really helped me like him more.
I agree, because it confirmed what you thought just from seeing him on telly, and indeed his pictures of his extreme exuberance and being very funny and very, very enthusiastic and friendly. And one of the things he said to Christopher Sykes was the key to his longevity was have two good laughs a day, and he was a great laugher, you could see on TV. Christopher is also brilliant at explaining his painting as well. There's a trip he took in near Bridlington, the two of them, and David Hockney said to Christopher as they're driving, "What colour is the road?" Christopher said, "Oh, well, it's the colour of tarmac. It's sort of grey." And David Hockney went, "Oh, you should look a little more closely at it." And on they drove. And after 40 minutes, Hockney said, "What colour's the road now?" And Christopher now got it. He said, "Yes, I can see now. It's got blue in it and some green and flashes of yellow." And Hockney said, "You have to use your eyes to look at things." And ever since I've read that, just been in Wales, I've spent a lot of time looking at the tarmac on my bike, and it is hundreds, probably thousands of different colours, which you just assume that it's grey, and it applies to everything: the sky, the hedges, the birds, the sea, which Hockney said was the hardest thing, or water, hardest thing of all to paint.
I don't know if you saw that sort of Hockney surround thing they did at the light box up in
I didn't know
Coldrops Yard. It was absolutely sensational, and everything, they had his voice going all the way through it, all the things he said, and it was always about look, 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 just look. So it was, I find this really, really lovely piece, actually, and it made me happy to give myself permission to like him as much as I hoped I'd like
yes.
him. And there's some wonderful photographs too,
which are taken by Christopher Sykes, who's a professional photographer himself. On a rather sadder front, your friend Anne Seber, author of The Women's Orchestra of Auschwitz, a terrific book, has written a moving but also accidentally or intentionally very funny article about condolence letters. Sadly, her husband, Mark, died in 2018, aged only 70, and she was inundated with condolence letters because he was so lovely and she was so lovely. And it's the last thing on earth she wanted.
This article spoke to me in it very, very loudly because I've had a lot of death in my family and amongst friends. And so I've written a lot of condolence letters. And I've also received a lot of condolence letters. And there's just a brilliant bit where she says, she's talking about the way they build up. What nearly dragged me down with my husband's death was the steady stream of letters from the hundreds of people I barely knew, as well as those I did. Long, carefully worded, well-phrased, handwritten in fountain pen, messages intended to, well, what exactly were they for? And the need to reply to them all was a task that simply made me sadder. When my mother died, she was so popular and so loved. I just was
overwhelmed. Who died relatively young, didn't she?
She did. She yeah. died at just touching 70. And it was. I'm afraid I did put the condolence letters in a box. I just never had the energy to, no. And I feel she's given me permission not
no,
to
but
have
why
to.
Did she? And she's very good on that impulse. I, like you, write them to friends when their loved ones die, and it is a good immediate reaction. But actually, what she says is very good about what you should say. And she says she's very honest. She says she didn't want loads of letters saying how wonderful Mark was. She said a recital of his virtues didn't bring him back, and it didn't lessen my grief. And she honestly says, I wanted people to write and tell me how wonderful I am, how
I
lucky Mark was to have had me as his wife. And I know Anne a tiny bit, not as well as you do, but she's an extremely nice, selfless person, not at all an egomaniac. But it really made me think for my next condolence letters to say something like that. Or what she also says, brilliantly at the end of her article, condolence letters were just one more reminder of all I had lost. Practical help in organising a memorial service or transferring a new name to a water bill could be far more valuable. So you are doing something in writing a letter. It's a nice thing to do, but you could channel that into doing something really literally helpful for somebody.
Has it made you rethink it? Because it has made me, because I automatically... Yeah. And she does say this brilliant thing. She said it's a duty people feel... Is it a duty people feel they have to undertake something they learned in school, as girls of my era were certainly taught during so-called etiquette lessons? Indeed, it's absolutely bred into us, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it's mandatory. And I'm just now wondering, A, do I need to, and does it help? Like she says, it might not. But also, all the things not to say, which I'm probably...
Yes, I'm guilty of practically all of them.
No, I bet you're not.
No. Well, I was once told by a friend that the good thing to say, which is say this, is that you must be feeling terrible grief, but grief can eventually go, unlike a minor irritation with living people. I'm annoyed by people who annoyed me 30 years ago, who will annoy me for the next 50 years. Major grief can decline, but anyway. And I'm going to follow her advice, and also actually a friend of mine's father did die the other day, and having read this literally, she suggested perhaps you should ring up. I did ring up, but actually he had a time difference thing. But I can see if you ring somebody up, they can decide to not answer or answer if they want. They don't have to write a letter back.
No.
And, you know, I think it's got much worse the last 20 years with the internet. I spend, I would say, without exaggerating, about 10% of my working day replying to emails, probably more.
Yes, it's so true. And she does say that, doesn't she? She says, "So what should you do? Send a quick text. May I phone you?" And she says, "You know, I find a human voice and chat were comforting, because really, what we're trying to do is comfort them, and the letter just isn't doing that. It's just giving them another
or cheer them up."
Yeah,
I thought a brilliant thing. I'm a huge fan of Larry David, the American comedian who did the brilliant series Curb Your Enthusiasm. And his real-life best friend, called Richard Lewis, also a comedian, who also appears in Curb Your Enthusiasm, died. And when he died, Larry David was incredibly funny. Even in his condolence message, he said, better than this, but I love Richard so much, but I can never, ever, ever, ever forgive him for dying before I did. Anyway, it's just, at times like that, being funny, or even better, being rude, in the best with the best intentions, is a godsend, as opposed to cloying, well-meant cliches. But in a jollier article in the August issue of The Oldie, Simon Robinson has written a lovely article about the Tun-Up Club. David Attenborough is a new member. Elizabeth II was very nearly a member of the Tun-Up Club, and Sam Robinson, who specialises in writing about veterans of the Second World War, knows many of the greats who've turned 100, and it's an increasing band.
Actually, Simon's written, he has written quite a lot for us, and he's really, really, if anybody knows about 100-year-olds and more, he does. And Christian Lamb, who I have interviewed, actually, for The Oldie, about... for growing old disgracefully, because she went on some mad caper, you know, jumping. You know, she and her friend Patricia Ottram are always doing things like jumping out of planes or
the Mirage and
rally driving. Yeah. Yes, she's now 105, turning 106. She's on the eve of her 106th birthday, Christian now. And Simon's hilarious. He's got this word. Enters the category known as semi-supercentenarian. A term she greeted with characteristic amusement. I mean, it sounds like something out of Mary Poppins.
They are people who... Semi-supercentenarians are those who are over 105. There's a category above that, which is supercentenarians, who are 110 or over.
Here's what he's reminding us of. It's 103. Christian celebrated her birthday by flying in a Miles Magister Second World War aircraft, complete with an open cockpit. No sitting quietly in an armchair for her. Even now, she insists on climbing the stairs twice a day to keep her active. I mean, she is absolutely phenomenal.
Quite often in the papers, when someone turns 100 or 105, they're interviewed, and there's one form of centenarian who says, I've smoked every day, drank myself stupid, only drink double cream all day, saying that none of that matters. And then there's another lot, which I suspect is probably the larger group, who do look after themselves, but also get on with things, not just flying in a Miles Magister Second World War aircraft. But I've met many of these people at Aldi lunches. They're completely free of self-pity, and normally they go on working. He talks about Colin Bell, who's 105, who's just written a memoir of his time as a fighter pilot in the Second World War. And he worked as a solicitor until, I think, 98. But so keeping on working, having a purpose, enjoying life, it sounds like a cliche, and being lucky enough to avoid all the fatal illnesses. But free of self-pity and doing stuff seems to be crucial.
I agree. And another thing about this article, that I was really shocked by the statistic. So today, with the UK population approaching 70 million, there are an estimated 16,600 centenarians. That's extraordinary. Mm. Because then he goes on to say, when Christian was born in July 1920, average life expectancy was a little more than 59, and there were only around 110 centenarians recorded in Britain. I mean, that's extraordinary.
That's amazing. And actually, you know, the world is not in a very happy position at the moment. Terrible things going on. But it is worth remembering things like that, that the average age of dying is much, much older, and the amount of people reaching 100 zoomed up like that. And there's something consoling about that. There's also something very, very immediately interesting about people who live forever. I remember Jean Calment, the French lady, who lived to 122, lived from 1875 to 1997. And the little Mademoiselle Camon met Vincent van Gogh as a teenager when he visited her uncle's shop, describing him as ugly as sin and bad-tempered. And I love those jumps across the ages. It's extremely pleasing that you might... We could have met Miss Calmont, and we could have met someone who met Vincent van Gogh.
Extraordinary, yeah. No, we love that.
So that's all in the August issue of The Oldie. Thanks so much, Fruity.
Thank you.
The Oldie is a huge fan of Hebridean Island cruises. Their small ships carry between just 38 and 48 guests around the Scottish islands, lochs and coastlines. It's all about comfort, good food, fascinating excursions, and a very personal atmosphere. To discover more and get savings of up to 20%, visit hebridean.co.uk or search for Hebridean Island Cruises. This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.